Welcome to It's Who You Know, the podcast, bridging the gap between Jewish leaders and those who follow them. Gain insight from Jewish professionals who make the decisions that influence your Jewish world.
Welcome to It's Who You Know. This is your host, Michelle W. Malkin. My guest today is Cheryl Cook, who is the Chief Executive Officer of Avodah. Thank you so much for joining us today, and welcome, Cheryl.
It's a pleasure, Michelle. It's great to be on your show.
So take us a little further back. I mean, was this always, you know, Jewish communal professional? I thought I was the only one with that path, but how did you come into this?
I'll bet there's a lot of us. I've worked in the Jewish community for my whole career, which is amazing and shocking. And I think, like so many of us, my first job was actually at a Jewish camp. So I was a counselor. I loved it. And I really, when I started thinking about what I wanted to do, and I definitely did not know what I wanted to do when I was in college, but when I got out of college and I started thinking about what I wanted to do, I realized that the thing that was closest to me was my Jewish community. I had grown up in a really vibrant Jewish community right outside of Detroit. My parents were involved in Jewish community. And I realized that there were things about the Jewish community I loved, many, many things, and things that I could see how things could be better. And I felt like who is better than me to try to step in and work to create the kind of community that I've always wanted to be part of. And so a lot of my desire to work in the Jewish community has been to create that kind of community, something that will make me proud. And so many parts of our community do make me proud.
That's awesome. So right out of college, I assume you didn't go straight to work for Hillel, or was that, what was the path?
No.
I mean, did you go study biology before coming over?
There's many jobs actually before the whole bio that you read. It's just too long because, right. You know, I'm middle-aged. I have a long bio before this, but I worked right after college. I worked as an intern for UJA Federation of New York. So this was long ago, far away. It was definitely that, I love that your show is called It's Who You Know, because my parents were involved in Federation. Mm. And essentially the then CEO of the organization gave me an internship to just launch my career. And honestly, I was writing letters for people. I was planning small events. It was just a leg in to start to see, what is this work? What am I doing? And then I went straight to graduate school. So I spent 3 years at JTS Columbia studying social work, studying Jewish studies. And it was not actually the most traditional place to go. It was not a degree in Jewish communal studies, but I felt like it was an opportunity as an adult to study Jewish studies in a serious context at the same time while getting a professional degree. So it was just a really nice wrap around for me to start to learn as an adult. And that's something I've also tried my hardest to pursue, even as I've been a professional.
Right. That's wonderful. And so how did this opportunity at Avodah present itself to you?
I think in the best way. So when I was at JTS, I watched from the sidelines as our founder, Rabbi David Rosen, started the organization. It was essentially an idea in his head at the time. And he said, if I graduate from rabbinical school and nobody has started an organization that's like the Lutheran Service Corps, the Jesuit Service Corps, right? There's all these service corps out there. If there's not one that started in the Jewish community, I'm going to start it. And indeed he did. And that was back in 1998. He started the organization. It has launched and grown. And I was brought in after watching from the sidelines for many years by the last executive director before me, Marilyn Schneiderman. I was friendly with her. She called me and said, come into my office. Let's have a drink. And I came in. We sat down. We went outside and sat down. And she said, look, Cheryl, I'm leaving my job and I want you to apply. And I'm not the decision maker here, but I really want to encourage you to apply. And I have to say, I talk a lot about being a women leader. I really think that that moment was pivotal in me stepping into this job and me putting my application forward.
Right. And it's, we always think about succession planning, and it always feels like it has to be this very heavy, you know, a lot of investment in somebody in the organization that you're going to pull through, or, you know, this time intensive and intentional. And even just something as simple as saying, hey, I recognize, you know, where you are at your career and what wonderful work you've done. And, you know, I'd like you to succeed me. That succession plan is good enough, right? Because clearly it worked out okay, right? Clearly you know, were correct fit for this position and were able to take it over from her, which was great.
Yeah, happily, I think so. And I guess I would also just add to that, that what is so surprising to me, but maybe also bears out in my experience, is that women, and I can speak for myself, are often reluctant to step into a bigger job if they don't meet every qualification. Have I done everything right on this list of all the things I'm supposed to have done? And I do think that that kind of mentorship by someone in leadership to someone who, you know, who we see as potential leaders is just so important, and especially mm-hmm. for women. So right. I feel really grateful. I'm super grateful to Marilyn. Thank you if you're listening, Marilyn.
Right. Well, and it's a lesson to anyone kind of in that position where, you know, they're ready to step down. It's not just that you're looking at people in your organization, but just your network of, you know, who are the other, female or not, you know, it doesn't really make too much difference, but who are those people that you know and trust and can groom in that way. So before we get kind of more into the work of the organization, I really like to ask for people who've been in their position for a little bit longer. You've been there for almost 5 years now. What were the expectations when you first started this role in terms of what you thought either, I mean, obviously you knew what the organization did, you know, were following it for some time. What was the expectations you thought of being in this kind of position with this organization that, you know, 5 years later, you're like, oh, that was very different than what I thought on day one or what I expected on day one?
Oh, I mean, first, let me just back up and say, I remember walking into my office on my first day of work, and this was my first time being an executive director. I stepped into my office and I had the most glorious staff. They had set up quotes. They had pictures and quotes from people all over the country who were part of Avodah, staff and participants and alumni welcoming me. And so I had these images all over my office. They had even reached out to my children and my husband, and they were holding big signs saying, "Welcome to Avodah." And this was all over my office.
That is
and
so sweet.
It was the most spectacular way to be welcomed to a position. I felt very warmly welcomed. And I think, you know, when I stepped into this job, Avodah was already about 15 years old. So we were already, you know, we were in our past our early stages and in mm-hmm. our adolescence, which means we had some programs that were really spectacular programs. The things that were harder for us organizationally, and I could see this right away, was we weren't well known. We had invested so much in the programs, in the people coming through the programs, but our communication shop, our recruitment shop, they were small. They were really, really small. And we hadn't invested money in them to really grow and make sure people understood what we were doing. And so a lot of the work at the beginning was just starting to, I really wanted to assess where we were and understand it, and then just starting to push those pieces out. How do we raise our profile? What could that look like? Who were the people to do that? And how do we make sure that our recruitment is really happening, not just from people who know people, which obviously networking is the best way, but if we wanted to break out of the box of just having the same people in every year, how did we break that open? And I would say that's work that we're still continuing today. I have really built on the foundations of that early work in terms of what I'm doing today to make sure that Avodah is reaching more people, is really meeting the needs of people, of Jews of color, of Jews with disabilities. We've started thinking about that. We have far to go. Thinking about meeting the needs of Sephardi Jews and Mizrahi Jews, and making sure we're not what a lot of us often fall into, which is what I would call Ashkenazic centric. So thinking about how Absolutely. Do we push that forward, and that there's been a lot of work that we've done across the board for the last few years about that.
Wonderful. And is there anything that, like, about your own leadership, so you've never been in a position like this, that surprised you over the years, that you're like, oh, I didn't realize that I struggled more in this area, or I didn't realize I'd be like that as in this particular position, or, you know, I'm sought after for a podcast. So weird.
I was a number two for 9 years before stepping into this position. And I felt really comfortable being in that position. It was fun. I had a great and vibrant CEO I was working with. I was able to really think internally about the structure of the organization. And one of the questions I had was, what would it be like when I really sat in this seat? How would it be to be the face of the organization? What did I want to learn from all the different leaders that I had worked under? What were the great lessons I could learn that I could take with me? And what were the things that I didn't want to do? And sitting in this seat, it's really allowed me to the best of my ability, to really make change, to create the kind of organization that I want to see, which for me means, what are the values that we're trying to live out in the world, and how do we live them internally? How do I think about policies and how they affect my staff, and how are those based on Jewish values? How are those based on social justice values? And how do I make sure that I'm really taking the input of my staff, informing those policies, for example? So I would say that one of the exciting pieces of being in a job like this has been being able to see that I now have the ability to shape so many of the pieces of the organization in the way that I could have dreamed. I always dreamed of this when I was 25 working in a Jewish organization. I now get to do that. And likewise, I get to bring creativity to the table. I get to see and stretch my own creativity to think about what is possible for Avodah. How do we take an organization that is investing in and developing Jewish leaders to work for social justice and really push out the impact that we can have? And that aspect of being able to be creative has been so exciting in this role.
That's awesome. That's really awesome. So you kind of alluded to some of the work, but let's dive into it. What is the organization? What does it do? How does it do? And where is it in its organizational lifestyle, other than being a moody teenager?
Maybe we're past moody.
I guess now in 20. So back to the party.
We are in... That's right. We're young adults. We know a lot, and there's still some things we don't know. So Avodah strengthens the Jewish community's fight against the causes and effects of poverty in the United States. And we're really thinking about, what would it look like if we could get rid of poverty, rid our society of poverty in this country? It's not a simple question. And it's certainly not a simple solution. And one of the things about Avodah is we love to deal with complex questions. So one of the ways that we do that is we invest in and develop Jewish leaders to work for social justice. So the program we're best known for is our Jewish Service Corps. That's the program that Rabbi David Rosen founded in 1998 with 9 people in a house living in New York City, and then working out in the world in placements, in different kinds of justice placements. So people might be working in immigration or domestic violence or housing or homelessness. Anything that touches poverty are the kinds of places where somebody at Avodah might be working. And that program has really grown and flourished. So again, it started with 9 people. We now have 75 people a year in 4 cities around the country, and we're about to open our 5th city. And they're all working in amazing organizations, some of the most creative, important organizations in our country and not-for-profits. And they spend their year working there. They spend their year living together. And they spend their year learning. It's all rooted in Jewish learning, rooted in justice learning, rooted in learning about who they are as people. And out of that program, we've created other programs, other initiatives. So we have programs like our Justice Fellowship, which is for young adults who are in their 20s and 30s, who are not looking for a job, are already working, are already based in some way in what I would call broadly defined social justice work. So they might be a librarian, they might be a social worker, they might be a lawyer, and we bring them together, create a sense of community and learning about who they are. What are the skills to create change at their organization or in their lives? How do they bring their full identity to the work that they're doing?
Is this virtually, or is it actually
right now community-based. So that program is in New York, Chicago, and Kansas City. And it's a program that we're looking to grow in our next few years. It's a program that's been fabulous for people who participated in it and really builds a sense of community and skills. And all of those people become part of our alumni network. So we have this 1,200 person alumni network that's really vibrant, where people are asking questions of each other, inviting each other over for Shabbat. If you pick up and move to a new city, the first thing people tell me they do is they contact the people, they reach out to the people from Avodah in that city. Nice. So they have instant community. It's kind of a, you know, the old fashioned kind of idea of a synagogue as community. This is Avodah as community, but national.
Right. So when I was in graduate school, I did, I focused on social justice issues, and I did a survey of people in Los Angeles, Jews, how they engage, or do they sign petitions? Do they make phone calls? You know, how do they engage in social justice work in LA? And I, you know, I had to do a lot of research beforehand in terms of what is Jewish social justice? And I called Avodah and I was like, hey, why aren't you in LA? and the answer I received was, you know, there's not the kind of infrastructure that we normally look for a program. So I say all this and kind of going to the, you know, when you look at the cities that you're in, right? New Orleans, DC, New York City, Chicago, Kansas, obviously DC, New York, and Chicago make a lot more sense. New Orleans, I guess, makes a little bit of sense. And then you have, you know, Kansas City dropped in there. And it just feels like the possibility of growth in terms of, you know, I mean, LA, just because I'm from there, but like has an enormous homeless population issue in terms of poverty and housing. And, you know, Portland is a really sort of big community for these kind of things. Houston, Texas has a giant community. There's lots of places that have big Jewish communities. So in sort of, you know, not to diverge too much in terms of future thinking, you know, why Kansas City? And, you know, and what would be next? Like this, I feel like this could be, you know, expanded to so many other cities that I'm surprised it hasn't already.
Michelle, I love that you're asking that because, I mean, what you're saying really follows all the studies, right? The Pew study, the report that I have to remember the name of, and you'll remember.
Right.
They all ask these questions about what is most important to you about your Jewish identity. And the answer often in the top percentage of answers was social justice.
Mm-hmm.
But social justice for so many people helps them express their Jewish identity. And so it is really, I would say, there's a real need for more programs that really bring together the Jewish and social justice. And it's a really beautiful synthesis to bring those two pieces together. There's so many values, the dignity of all people, or welcoming the stranger, or even the idea of Shabbat and taking a day off and not working.
Right.
So many of those pieces are really about social justice. And it's a way to frame Jewish life in a way that speaks to us today. And so I would say, we're part of a network, and we're part of a network of, I think it's 57 organizations right now that are part of the Jewish Social Justice Roundtable. And so I've seen proliferation of organizations. Avodah continues to grow, and we're really on a growth path right now. We're actually going to open in San Diego this summer, which
Yay!
Is our first country in California. And may that be the beginning of more.
Right.
We really decided that, I mean, I'll answer your question about why we're in the places we are, but I would say we're ready to grow. We're looking to grow, and we're looking for communities that are excited for us to come to them. It feels like it needs to be a real partnership. And so San Diego, it's been a real partnership. We're partnering with Jewish Family Service on the ground there, which is one of the most creative organizations I've seen. They are thinking about how at the largest border crossing in the world, how they're dealing with immigration and asylum seekers and refugees who are really often landing on sidewalks or in detention centers right. and need a lot of support and help. And Jewish Family Services really stepped up and has created something called the Rapid Response Network with Catholic Charities, with the ACLU to all work together. And so we're going to be partners with all of them. We're going to be placing people in those organizations and partnering to help create leaders to work on immigration in the future. So it's exciting to be coming into San Diego, and may we grow to LA soon.
I mean, but I get it, you know, I mean, and I assume that that's how New Orleans kind of came about, that there was clearly, you know, a need and a structure that could support that, that you guys were able to sort of galvanize on so that to make sure that you were successful in that space.
I would actually tell you New Orleans is a really interesting story. I was not here at the time, but the Avodah board had just passed a strategic plan, actually with a lot of the components of what I ended up implementing just a few years ago. This was back in 2007, I believe. And they had just passed a strategic plan. And then Hurricane Katrina happened. And when Hurricane Katrina happened, the New Orleans was decimated. People fled. The people who were left really were living in poverty. And then people started to come back. And the Jewish community was really looking to rebuild itself. Our founder, David Rosen, flew down there with our board chair at the time to see what was going on and really said to the Jewish community, are you interested in having Avodah come on, be on the ground? And indeed, they said yes. Mm. We started a program there. And here we are, I think it's 13 years later.
Right.
And we have been on the ground. What they say in New Orleans in the Jewish community is a lot of people came to help right after Hurricane Katrina, which was phenomenal. But Avodah stayed. And we planted seeds. And a lot of people who came through Avodah stayed in the city and are now building families, building their life there. So that has been meaningful. And one of the things we bring to communities is a real sense of building community, building a young, vibrant Jewish community that really is connected to Jewish community, is thinking about Jewish identity. So that's part of our story in New Orleans. Kansas City is a phenomenal city. And it is a city that has a lot of people who come back after they've left for a few years. They may have left for college. They may have left for a few years even after college. And a lot of people are coming back and then looking to connect and looking for community. Many people are from there. Some people land there because of jobs. And so one of the things we've been able to do there is really build year after year a fellowship in a cohort of people. So we now have people who have been through our program on the ground in Kansas City who are thinking about their Jewish lives. They're thinking about how they create, how they help, how they're change makers in the world. And they're really on the ground as powerful leaders. I'm super excited about that. And I have to say, one of the best things about the work we've been doing is, for the most part, Jewish federations and other legacy organizations have been really supportive of our work, have really seen something in Avodah, something about creating Jewish leaders that has been exciting. And so we've been in Kansas City and in many other cities, we've gotten funding from many of those organizations, which has been meaningful to us.
That's fantastic. That's fantastic. So in thinking about kind of the arc and the sort of life of your organization and the work you've done within the Jewish Social Justice Roundtable, what are some challenges that you're seeing? What are some issues that you're discussing with your colleagues in terms of the work that you do? Or is everything awesome?
There's always challenges. I mean, I think part of growing an organization and part of our beautiful Jewish community is figuring out what are the things that can be strengthened. Mm-hmm. And so I see them as, where are the places where we have the possibility of making this better, stronger, and speaking to more people? And so to me, one of the biggest places where I see the need for strengthening is around making sure that we're really listening to all the voices in our community, and that all the voices in our community are really held up, that we have people on our staffs, on our boards, in our organizations as participants who are Jews of color, who are people with disabilities, who are people who come from from more low-income households. Mm-hmm. And so making sure that we're not just replicating, you know, so I'm speaking for myself, I'm a white Ashkenazi Jew, and I don't want to just replicate making sure that everybody in my surroundings looks like me,
right.
Has my, you know, comes from my same perspective. So making sure we're bringing in lots of different people and that our organizations represent the beautiful diversity of our community. And I think that there's a lot of work to do. I see it happening. I see powerful people like Yavila McCoy, who is one of my sheroes, doing incredible work, and many, many, many others. I feel like I could give a long list, but really pushing our community to say, how do we all do better? So that's one of the biggest issues. The other thing that I think is a challenge, and again, I see it being worked on, is just making sure that we see the potential of who could step into leadership, like thinking about what right. are the models of leadership and really thinking about cracking those models open. So traditionally in our community, a leader, right, when I grew up, a Jewish leader was, right, most probably, not always, but probably 90% of the time, a white man, probably great, dynamic, interesting, who probably had a spouse at home who was taking care of the kids if they had them, and didn't need to be thinking about all of those different pieces or had someone else thinking about that so they could devote their entire life,
right,
every day and every hour to the work that they were doing. And that's just not feasible anymore. That's not feasible for most people, men, women, anyone.
Right.
And not only that, but it's not the model of finding the best leaders out there. I lead a Jewish organization. I'm also a mom of two little boys. I am a spouse. I sit on the board of an organization and I'm involved in my children's school. And so all of those pieces together are pieces that I need to devote myself to. And when the board actually offered me the job of executive director 5 years ago, I said back, look, I want to be upfront that I can't travel all the time.
Right.
I can't be away every weekend. I can't work 24 hours a day. And if that's the person you're looking for, I'm not the right person. Mm. But if you want someone who is not only gonna, you know, make sure that I'm doing what needs to happen, but also holding up other people in the organization and giving them the ability and skills to do some of that work, then right. hire me, because that is what I'll do. And certainly I would say that creating alternative models for leadership that allow people to be flexible, to be, to work from home sometimes, to be at their children's performance at school, but also maybe work late at night. That kind of flexibility has been really mm-hmm. meaningful for me. And it's actually something I've passed along to my staff. And I've seen that change happening in the Jewish community, certainly from when I first started.
Yeah, and that's a hard change too. And I think, you know, a little bit better here, but I think there's also the like, it's difficult to understand that work-life integration in terms of, you know, it's okay that I'm answering emails at 9 o'clock at night because that's when I'm finding time because I'm also going grocery store shopping at 3. Like, I need to have that flexibility in order to do this job well. And if you have a problem that I'm not fitting within these 9 to 5, you know, hours and that's when I'm doing my work and there's not that very clear-cut separation, then like, as you said, you're bored and this isn't going to work, right? Then it's not going to work in terms of me being able to do my best work at the hours and times that work for me. And, you know, I feel very guilty sometimes. I work in a synagogue and I send emails on Saturday and, you know, I try not to send them to the rabbi and cantor specifically, but like if a lay leader reaches out to me and texts me, I'm not going to say, you know, it's Shabbat. I'm not texting. You know, and some people are very good about setting those boundaries of saying there's no technology on Saturdays and we, you know, make that separation for Shabbat. I make that separation for, you know, the times I need to make that separation, even if that's a Tuesday or a Sunday or whenever I decide to make that separation. So I think it's difficult in the Jewish community where the Jewish community is saying to us, you have to make that separation Friday night to Saturday. And I'm saying, Well, but I want to make that separation from, you know, Monday afternoon to Tuesday evening because I want to go to the zoo in the middle of the week with my kid. And that's the time I'm not going to answer emails or answer your phone calls. And that needs to be okay. I think we're getting there, as you said. I think more people are understanding that, but it's not, I've constantly always gotten the, well, you're sending emails at 11 and you're expecting me to respond and I don't want to respond. Yeah. I've never asked you to respond. And I get it that just receiving an email feels like you're expecting a response, but I'm not timing like your response. And unless it's been 4 days, I'm not, you know, seeing when you respond back to me and be like, oh man, you waited till 6 a.m. You know, that's not acceptable. But that whole work-life balance, and that's really self-aware of you. Because I think, I don't want to say time for most people, but for myself, if I was offered that job, I'd be like, yes, like, let's do it. So exciting. Instead, you know, you having that self-awareness of, you know, hey, I operate a little differently. And, you know, there are CEOs that are completely outward facing and are the face and the name and the promoter of the organization. And there are CEOs and executives that, you know, say, hey, I want to make sure my staff is happy. I want to make sure, you know, internally we're doing well, our finances are good. And there's, you know, just different types of people that serve this role in a different way. So that's fantastic. You have that awareness enough to go to them and say, I'm in as long as you want me as I am, which is awesome.
Yeah. I mean, and I also want to say, even within that, it's hard. It's hard. And I am really privileged because I live in a house where I have a lot of support. I have my mother-in-law and my sister-in-law. I live in an old family brownstone that my husband's family lives in, and we moved in. And a lot of the support that I get is from family. It's very old school. I feel That's like, awesome. You know, if you went back 100 years, this is what our families would look like. Right. I'm a huge proponent of it. And I think that stepping into a role as a leader and trying to balance a lot of needs is really hard. And so I would just say that, sure, that you have support, making sure that you have good support so that you don't get overwhelmed.
Absolutely. And that's, you know, and sometimes it's, you know, it's paid support. I mean, I just went to a couple conferences in Chicago back to back, and, you know, we brought our son and we hired babysitters and we figured it out and we got that support. And if you, you know, want to be in these roles and you have two, you know, people that are working, that's just kind of how you figure it out.
Throw out a challenge for all of us, myself included, as a Jewish organization? I think we've done well, and I think we have more to go. And so I would say, many people working in the Jewish community are they're either single or they're two parents, both working. So how do we want to think about that kind of childcare? What can we contribute toward the cost when our staff need to work on a weeknight or on the weekend? What's possible? I don't know the answer to this, but I think that there's a challenge here that we could start to crack if we put our minds together. We've cracked much harder things.
Right.
What would it look like if we actually, and this is something we're still struggling with, so I want to name, this is not perfect for Avodah, and I think it's something we need to be thinking about as a community to make sure that we are the best places to work for our staff. That if we hit that, it's not just about salaries. The salaries are really important, but what kind of benefits, what kind of flexibility, what do our staff need to really feel like they can bring their whole selves to work and really function well and properly? What kind of health care? What are the other kinds of things that would be helpful? And sometimes I try to think about that for myself. I ask my staff some of those questions, but I think we can retain staff and we can be great places to work if we crack some of these issues.
And I think that's not always, especially in where I'm at in a synagogue, it's just not always, you know, the first thing, right? The first thing is your mission. The first thing is the work. The first thing is your finances, right? And so even coming into this position where they know you, they hadn't had an executive director before, I'm like, you got to have a staff happiness line. I'm like, you've got to have something in here that brings your staff together. Is it a party? Is it even just a holiday lunch? Like, And thankfully, I have wonderful leadership that are like, oh, of course we should have been doing that. Here's whatever you need. But if it's not something that you've sort of either been trained to think about or been brought to your attention through whatever other mediums you find information, it's really easy to forget. It's really easy to forget. So we've veered so much into the personal, which is awesome. You know, how you keep your own life balanced in terms of help and support is what I heard. But let me come back to the organization for just a minute longer and kind of wrap up that piece in terms of, what's the future? What are you seeing? I mean, your younger organization, and I've talked with a lot of what I will call millennial organizations that started 2000 or later. And you, I guess you're just on the cusp of that. And the relationship between those organizations and our legacy organizations. And a lot of what I've heard is, you know, we could never exist without, you know, the support of these legacy organizations. And it feels, you know, just even as I'm talking to you, I'm like, just the regular life cycle of a human, right? You know, somebody who's 20 needs, you know, somebody who's 50, 60, 70, 80, 100. Maybe not 100, but, you know, older in their life, supporting them through, you know, the creation of something new. And in previous conversations, specifically, you know, with Dan and Lex, with all the respect, you know, their philosophy is, you know, we're done. We're done with the old model. We're done with those old organizations. It's not working. Shut it down, you know, put it away and encourage these new things that are really connecting with people. And so when you think about the next, you know, 20 years of Avoda, when it starts to go from being an adolescent to a middle-aged, you know, person with possibly with children in terms of, you know, other organizations that have spun off from your work, you know, you have this this fellowship you did, you still have your houses and programs and maybe it's, you know, some other things that come into the works over the next, you know, 20 years. What's the vision there? Like, what's the hope and is it contingent on those continual partnerships with our legacy organizations, or is it something a little more independent?
Sure. One of the things that's unique about Avoda is that we have relationships with many, many, many organizations out in the United States that are not Jewish. So we have relationships with lots and lots and lots of other organizations who are working on immigration, who are working on domestic violence, right? Amazing organizations. And so one of the things that we've been thinking about is how do we connect those organizations that are doing important work in our country to the Jewish community more? And what do those connections look like? How do we make sure that our community knows some of the best work happening? We don't have to replicate everything. So many initiatives, many Avodonics who have come through programs, who have come through our program, have started their own initiatives or have started initiatives at the organizations that they work at that are also serving that start to also serve the Jewish community. So, for example, Sanctuary for Family, which is an incredible organization that works on anti-trafficking and domestic violence in New York, one of our core members was there for a year working with people who were victims of abuse, and she then went to Federation in New York and said, "We should do this." Within the Orthodox, she was Orthodox, and she said, what if we were able to extend these services to the Orthodox and ultra-Orthodox community? Here's an organization that already knows how to do this work. What if we extend this? And UJ Federation indeed gave a grant, and she was able to help build out a program that is actually meeting the needs of many of the ultra-Orthodox people in our community who need those services. And to me, that's a perfect way to see the blend of the legacy, new organizations, even other organizations that might not be in our Jewish communal orbit. There's lots of ways for us to partner together. I'm not a radical in terms of saying, let's get out with the old and in with the new. I believe we're always morphing. So for Avoda, our network is now 1,200. May we have a network of 5,000. And it won't be long, right? If we add a couple hundred a year, and in the next year or two, we'll be adding a couple hundred a year, we're going to grow and grow and grow. We're going to grow a network of people who really have a vision of how to bring their Jewish values, but also their justice values into any workplace that they go into. So one of the stories I like to tell is from Jenna Gold. Jenna Gold works at GE, not a social justice organization, right? A big company. She does HR at GE. And one of the stories that she told me is she did Avoda. When she started at GE, she had come out of workforce development. And she thought she was going to be supporting people in their workplace to grow and thrive. And her first thing that she was given is she had to let, they were cutting a factory, and she had to let a lot of people go. And she said that she first, after being horrified, she took a step back and said, how do I apply what I learned at Avoda to this situation?
Right.
And she basically went to her supervisor and said, what if, as we do this, we use some of the resources of GE to hold a fair, and connect with other employees and really try to connect people to other positions so that we're not just leaving our workforce in the lurch, that we have an obligation to people who have been employed by us. And she really beautifully talked about how she was able to make that connection. I believe that we would all be stronger if we have, we would all be better at our jobs and better at seeing what's going on in our country and in the wider world if we actually get close to some of the struggles of what's going on in this country. So my one of my other heroes, Bryan Stevenson, who is, if you haven't read his book, Just Mercy, I highly recommend it. He is the executive director of Equal Justice Initiative. He says this thing. He says, when we get close, we hear things that can't be heard from afar. We see things that can't be seen. And sometimes that makes the difference between acting justly and unjustly. And so I take that to mean we need to be on the ground listening to voices that we don't always hear. For Avoda, that's about people in poverty. And I want more people to be hearing those voices. I sometimes dream of what it would look like if we really were able to push forward this vision of every young person in this country does a year of service after college or after whatever they're doing, right? At a certain age, between the ages of 18 and 22, every young person does a year of service, has an opportunity to meet people who are different from them, has an opportunity to listen to people, see some of the struggles that are happening in our country. How different would our country be if we all saw that, if we did our work with those voices in our head, whatever work we end up doing, if we worked as a social worker, as a synagogue executive director, or on Wall Street with those voices in our head. So to me, Avoda is really about extending some of our programs to make sure that we're really giving people the opportunities to have these conversations. So our Service Corps is a piece of the program. Our Justice Fellowship is a piece. And the other pieces are we're developing, and I believe this is part of what our future will look like. We're developing curriculum conversations for synagogues, for youth groups, for Hillels to talk about what's Jewish about social justice. How do we think in not a black and white way, but in a more nuanced way about some of the hardest questions that we're facing? And how do we really try to open ourselves up to hear other voices, to listen, and then to take some kind of action based on our learning?
That's awesome. That's a fantastic vision. That's great. That's great. So to bring it back to you a little bit and sort of thinking about who's listening to this conversation and Jewish professionals that are in, you know, all sorts of kinds of organizations or lay leaders that are involved. And thinking about your own staff, right? Thinking about your own staff listening to this conversation. What's some advice that you would give those people in the field, you know, whether they are dealing with, you know, various challenges or successes or, you know, they're just sort of daily work?
Sure. So first, I'm going to go back to something I said earlier, which is I really encourage people, anyone, to apply, to think big, and apply for things that you may feel are just a step beyond you. Don't get caught up in you have to meet every qualification. I would say for myself, one of the things that I've found in my career is I often applied for a job, stepped into the interview. This happened to me, I think, 3 times and immediately realized this was not the right job for me. But it was the right organization and it was there was potential. And I actually, in multiple times, I worked with the executive director or leader to shape a job that was right for me. And I just think there's a lot of creativity out there. Some of our leaders are creative. Apply, see what's possible, write a kick-ass cover letter that really tells why, not just why you're right for this job, but why, what you bring, what you bring. I think that I have been convinced before. I have had jobs posted that are full-time and someone has applied for 4 days a week or 3 days a week and through their cover letter convinced me to interview. Mm-hmm. And I've been convinced to hire based on them. So I think that just seeing like what is written in black and white is not always the reality. Push and think beyond that. Not everybody is like that. Not every leader is like that, but many are. And I think that there's real opportunities out there for people to step forward. I think the other piece of advice I want to give is just to say that particularly for women in the field, for Jews of color, for trans Jews, for queer Jews, to say your voice really matters and we need you to step up and into leadership. We need more role models. We need more people who are really showing the diversity of our community to be in lots of different positions of power. Because we know in positions of power, we can create change. So I encourage people, step up and apply for jobs, step up and apply, try to get onto boards, try to influence organizations. It's also, it's not just for people, you know, it's for all of us. It's for us as a Jewish community to really say we need to change and to work actively to change it. So I'm thinking about this. Avoda is actively working on this. We're not fully there yet, but we're actively working on this. And I hope that anyone who hears this who is thinking about applying for a job really says, okay, I'm going to try. I can do it.
That's awesome. So in concert with change and jobs and titles and all that good stuff, talk to me a little bit about the change of your own job title from executive director to is it chief executive officer? Is that CEO?
Yeah, we talked. CEO. That just happened this summer. And that happened because Golly Cooks from Leading Edge wrote a spectacular piece saying that when she did research across the field, most men had the title of CEO and most women had the title of executive director. And that really showed a change in terms of the way we were positioning ourselves. And I, you know, recently did the op-ed project and the person who runs that project said, you have to start by really highlighting what you're good at and all the things you're good at and position yourself well. Golly really said, position yourself well. And so changing my title to CEO, and this was really my board's decision to do that, was really about saying we are a national organization doing incredible work. Why I see much smaller organizations with CEOs. Why, if the title is the thing that's holding us back, then let's break that open. And so it really was with Golly's plea to many organizations to look at this and change titles that my board decided to make that change.
Are there any other titles within your organization that you think should change?
Yeah, I'm thinking about that. I'm thinking about whether C-suite titles make sense for some of my staff. I've actually asked some of my staff to think about their own titles, what makes sense given what they're doing. I feel like titles at some level are important because it gives a sense of what someone is doing. And at some level, they're not so helpful. When I look at salary studies and I try to compare titles, it's somewhat unhelpful because there's so many factors that come into things. But I want people to feel like they have the title that that really showcases what they do.
Well, especially the Jewish community, right? Everybody to each their own in terms of, you know, I have friends that work in much, I don't want to say regulated, but much more clear industries where it's, oh, you're a, you know, you do post-production. This is what a post-production person does. Like it's regardless of where it is that they're doing it, it's the same. My sister's a pilot. She's a pilot. Like there's not much ambiguity about what it is that she did in that role. Whereas, you know, across our organizations, you know, I was a development manager, which I was the director of development, but in their culture, they didn't have directors of anything. Everybody was a manager. So even though we could have all shifted our, you know, titles to director of and been doing the exact same work, that another organization very clearly would be like, well, of course you were the director of development. Like, that's very weird that you were the manager of, you know, the philanthropy manager or whatever. And even, thankfully I'm now in a situation where executive director of a synagogue, that's pretty, you know, well known in terms of, you know, the kinds of things that I do. I just came back from a conference of executive directors, and it was very weird to look at the crowd and be like, oh wait, you all actually do the work that I do. Like, that's very cool, and like their own context. But that, you know, everything, every other place and every other title is always very kind of ambiguous between organizations in terms of, well, what does that really mean outside of this is the things that I did and the things I was able to accomplish in that role. So that's really great. So the last thing I really want to sort of touch upon is, you know, you mentioned your own life in terms of your family, and you were very lucky to have some extra support in your home. But, you know, what are some other ways that you keep it balanced, either, you know, for yourself? And I'm sure, even though you said I can't travel every weekend, I can only assume there is travel involved in your work, in sort of, you know, managing your staff and the outward appearance and all the things you want for this organization, and being there for your kids and your husband, or sorry, your partner, and just kind of moving forward with life. How do you keep it all together and balanced and happy, assuming that you do?
I am a Libra. I love the idea of balance, but I really don't fully believe in it anymore. Mm. I don't know that there is balance. I think that everyone's life is holistic. And so I bring my full self to work. And it means that sometimes I have a kid with a stomach virus that she had this week, and I have to work from home. And I try to do the best that I can. And then once he goes to sleep, I'm working at night. It means that I try to, you know, I take time off when I need it to be present. So next week, I'm going to take some days off to spend time with my family, even though we're staying in town. But it just means that I think for me, I just try to be present where I am. And I use my transport. I take the subway to and from work, and I use that time to actually kind of, to the best of my ability, let go of where I've been, let go of my work, and be present at home. And when I come from home to work, I try to do the same thing. Again, not perfectly, but that really helps me as a regular habit to just try to be present in the conversation I'm in.
Yeah, that's awesome. It's very important thing to think about. Very hard, but very, very important. Anything else from our conversation? We touched upon your personal journey into this position and the work of the organization and where it's going, and a lot about, you know, things that other professionals can learn in terms of pushing themselves kind of beyond their own boundaries. Anything else you want to touch upon before we wrap up?
I think the only last thing I would say is I think it's important to find mentors out there. I had many mentors in my life as I was coming up the ranks. I worked in the Jewish community my whole career. I think I was counting it up. It was 10 or 12 positions, something crazy, even beyond my resume. And I just think I have been really lucky to have so many mentors. And so I would say find people who will help, who will connect you. Reach out to people who are even, a lot of people will reach out to me and say, can I have 15 minutes or half an hour to just talk and get your thinking about something? Lots of people are open to that. You'd be surprised at how many people will say yes. So reach out to people that you've always wanted to meet. Set up time and really, I would say find people who you think are good to mentor you. Set those kinds of relationships up. To me, that was really helpful.
Yeah. And mostly all you have to do is ask, right? I think a lot of people are a lot of people are flattered when you ask them for some of your time or, you know, to help you think through something. And it's not always easy to ask, but.
Absolutely. And Michelle, this has been really fun. Thank you.
Oh, good, good, good. Well, thank you so much, Cheryl, for sharing your insights and everything about your experience and your hopes and dreams for AvoDAW, and really excited that you were able to participate.
Like this episode? Have a comment or a great suggestion for our next interview? Contact us through our website at itswhoyouknowthepodcast.com or on the It's Who You Know Facebook page. As always, subscribe, rate, and review this podcast so that others can find us. It's Who You Know, the podcast.